Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer conference call with David Sherman of River Park Strategic Income Fund. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note today's event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Mr. David Snowball. Sir, please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Jamie. Welcome to the Observer's Chat with David Sherman, President of Kahansic Management LLC and Manager of the River Park Strategic Income Fund, and Morty Shaya, President of the River Park Funds. I thought I'd begin with the obvious. About 80% of all mutual funds could shut their doors today, and they would not be missed. As a group, if I had to describe them, I'd use words like large, unimaginative, undistinguished asset sponges. They thrive by never being bad enough to dump, and so year after year, their numbers swell. By one estimate that I recently saw, 30% of all mutual fund money is now invested in closet index funds, nominally active funds whose strategy and portfolio are barely distinguishable from an index. Sadly, those are the funds with analyst coverage and investor attention. The mission of the Observer is to try to help identify the small, thoughtful, disciplined active funds whose existence actually matters. Dave Sherman runs such funds. This is one of a series of calls designed to allow you folks to hear a reflection on the fund's genesis and strategy directly from its manager, and second, to give you a chance to raise questions in person with the folks behind the fund. This is the first time we've spoken with a manager so soon after launch, but the decision seemed justified by the fact that this fund represents an extension of strategies with which David is very comfortable, and also by the widespread interest in the Observer community. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my conversation with David and Morty, and the final third to your questions. And so welcome, Morty. Congratulations on being sought out by Barron's this week, and condolences for the 10-word snippet that you were limited to.
Thank you, David. So I'm Morty Shaya, and I'm the president and CEO of River Park Funds, and we're honored to be taking part in this conference call that David Snowball has organized. River Park Funds currently has seven mutual funds. We believe all seven are exciting, different, unique, and don't fall into the category that David talked about as funds that, that we wouldn't miss, but rather, these are funds that we think are special and unique, and that's why we were excited to introduce them. A number of the funds are managed internally, and we've got currently three such funds that we're managing internally. Two of them are managed with the team that came with me from Barron Funds, where I was formerly president and chief operating officer. And the other four funds basically are sub-advised by advisors, teams that I've gotten to know over the years, and that I've sort of thought they did unique, different things, special things that I wanted to invest my own money in, and I wanted to create strategic alliances to bring those strategies to the marketplace in the form of mutual funds. So two of those funds are managed by David Sherman and his team at Kohansic. The first one that we launched 3 years ago is the Short-Term High Yield Fund, really a special, unique strategy that we almost thought of as a cash alternative strategy, as we were managing it to a very low duration, between 3 months and 7 months, with therefore, in our opinion, very low credit risk. And we targeted 3 to 4% yields, which obviously compared well versus money market funds. And we actually closed that fund to new investors a couple of months ago when it reached its capacity. It currently has about $900 million under management, and we're very comfortable managing it at that size, but frankly feel that if it was significantly larger than that, we'd have trouble, managing it to the same risk profile that we've managed, the fund for the last 3 years on. As we went through the process of closing that fund, we introduced the Strategic Income Fund, and that fund launched at the end of September. And unlike the Short-Term High Yield Fund, which really was targeted around how David and his team have historically managed their excess cash, the Strategic Income Fund, the new fund, the one we're talking about tonight, is really more mainstream Kohansic. This is really leveraging off of the skill set that they developed over the years that they've been running their firm. So it's much more mainstream. It's, in my mind, I think of it as still conservative, not as conservative maybe as the other fund, but still very conservative. You know, you'll hear David talk about money good securities, securities that we're very comfortable, you know, owning to maturity, where we think we're going to get paid full principal and interest. And we're going to run it at a relatively, especially in this interest rate environment, a relatively low duration, low maturity. You know, we're thinking, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 or 4 years, and currently it's running a little less than that. But again, it, we're targeting returns about double the short-term high-yield funds. So the short-term high-yield fund has been under 4% sort of on average. This is more targeted to 6 to 8 instead of 3 to 4. We're very excited that it's gotten a lot of investor interest in a very short period of time. It's currently not quite $100 million in assets under management, you know, basically 2 months after we launched the fund. So we're getting a lot of significant interest. It's very exciting to us. We're going to run this fund with a nimble, small, you know, maybe capacity of $2 billion, which in, you know, this universe is still very small. And that's really the heart of how we think we can accomplish the much higher yields relative to what we perceive the risk is in terms of the securities we're investing in. So we're very excited about the fund. And I'm going to turn it over to David now to talk through his background and to describe the fund. And then we'll, you know, open it up to a Q&A with both David and then with David Sumble. And then we'll open it up to the audience. So thank you.
Okay. I'm David Sherman. I'm the portfolio manager of River Park Short-Term High Yield Bond Fund, which is soft close to investors, and the newly launched River Park Strategic Income Fund that we launched on September 30th. As Morty mentioned, Cohansic and River Park started a joint venture in 2010, and we continue to go forward and try to be a boutique strategy in the credit space. Prior to starting Cohansic, which I started in 1996, I graduated from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and with my undergraduate business degree, I worked full-time immediately for a subsidiary of Leucadia National and spent 10 years at Leucadia National. When I left Leucadia National in 1996 after 10 years, my line responsibility was treasurer of their insurance operations, which was a $3 to $4 billion operation, and my staff responsibilities were to work on investments at the holding company level, whether they be a venture-driven or activist position, such as trying to go after Rock Center, or whether they were more speculative, like buying Russian securities, or whether it was buying distressed assets in bankruptcy, either as just outright investments or deals. With that background, we started Cohansic, and Cohansic today is 25% owned by DST Systems in Kansas City and a privately held company in Kansas City called Financial Holding Corporation. And employees and myself own 75%. And we, our first client was actually Leucadia, my former employer, who gave us $150 million of insurance company money to manage. And basically, the strategy that we employed to manage Leucadia's $150 million in 1996, when they had insurance companies, is the same strategy we are employing in the Strategic Income Fund. So effectively, we've been managing separate accounts off and on through the years, primarily for insurance companies in this area and arena. So with that said, I'll talk just for 2 minutes on what the old fund was so you have a sense of where we started, and then I'll go to the Strategic Income Fund. The old fund, the River Park Short-Term High-Yield Bond Fund that you may be familiar with, was our first mutual fund with River Park. We purposely created a mutual fund that we felt comfortable to understand the liquidity aspects of the business because mutual fund holders are depositors and we're investing longer than a day of daily liquidity. And the mutual fund was primarily started to be a cash alternative or a cash-enhanced strategy, and we were purposely going to keep the duration extremely short. So that fund typically has 75% or more of its portfolio maturing or expected to mature in less than a year. It typically has 40 to 60% of its portfolio rolling off in 30, 60, or 90 days. And that portfolio really, in this today's environment, and has historically produced sort of 3 to 4% net returns. And it's pretty much got a duration of about a 3-4 month bond portfolio. And a significant part of it consists of called and redeemed bonds, or companies that are going through an event where the bonds are going to be taken out early. And as a result of that, that's what really drives the capacity constraint of that product. To give you an idea, at the current size, that fund should purchase next year somewhere between $5 and $6 billion worth of securities, all that would be expected to roll off in a relatively short period of time. So once we started reaching the levels where we wanted to make sure we didn't have a capacity problem and be proactive, we started thinking about other skill sets that Cohansic has the ability of and naturally performs, and figure out what made sense. And also how to take advantage of some of the categories in the short-term fund where we're not as capacity constrained. And excuse me, as a result of that, we launched the River Park Strategic Income Fund. And that's what I'd like to talk about this evening. So the River Park Strategic Income Fund was launched on September 30th. And our primary way to look at this fund is we look at it and say we're buying a portfolio of what we deem to be money good debt instruments, primarily loans and bonds, that we're prepared to hold to maturity. It doesn't mean we necessarily will hold to maturity, but it means we're certainly prepared to hold the maturity. And we look at them and say, if the portfolio construct in today's market has a yield of X, let's, for argument's sake, say X is 7 or 8%, then we believe that that's the net return we can generate on the fund over the holding period or life of that portfolio. So let's say on average 4 years. We are not particularly interested in trying to guess whether the Fed's going to taper or not taper and when it's going to occur. We're not interested in speculating on interest rates or taking very big macro views. The portfolio itself, we've always been short-natured in maturity, so we would favor a 3-year bond over a 10-year bond generally anyway because of the tail risk of both uncertainty of interest rates and uncertainty of credit risk. So our goal is to really look at a portfolio where individuals and financial advisors can have a bond portfolio that they're holding and look at it almost like a yield or an annuity stream. And I've affectionately referred these to, you know, bonds I'd have my mother hold. And if something bad happens to my mother, fine, then, you know, we'll liquidate the portfolio in a timely fashion to help take care of those healthcare costs. But in the meantime, she can live off the income. And I'm not really interested in speculating or trying to make a lot of money on that portfolio in a total return basis, because my sister and I will earn our way and save our own way for savings. What we're really there is to protect mom's income stream and protect her principal. And basically, if we do a bad job at that, then we have to write checks to support mom in her older age anyway. So there's no point in being a fiduciary guarantor when there's enough good assets out there to generate enough yield that mom should have more than enough income than what her spending patterns are. And if something happens to me, it's a portfolio where my sister, who is not a financial person, could, and my mother, who's not a financial person, could feel comfortable holding to maturity, and that they would mature, meaning they would get all of their principal, all of their interest at the appropriate time. So that's sort of how I think about this portfolio. To get a better sense of money good, a lot of people will say, oh, it's money good, and they have lots of different definitions. We, too, have our sort of our own view of money good. So in my opinion, money good is the following. First, the bond or debt that we're purchasing today, we expect at maturity or prior to maturity, we will get all of our principal and all of our interest back. And in the event that the company were to file bankruptcy or restructure, we would get all our principal, all our interest, and all of our interest on interest back. So in an asset-backed security world today, where you can buy asset-backed securities in runoff, let's say at 88 cents on the dollar, and you believe that the ultimate recovery is 98 cents plus coupons, that would not be money good, because you're not getting 100 cents on your dollar back. That would be an asset that has value, not a money good security. The other way we look at it is we say, okay, we have a business model today. Do we feel comfortable that that has a long-term viable business? Because it's the maturity date that's ultimately going to determine it. So, for instance, to give somebody, some people some examples, I'm perfectly comfortable with XM satellite and satellite radio today, but I don't know the future of satellite radio 10 years from now. So So I'm uncomfortable buying a 10-year bond of XM Satellite, because in 10 years I have no idea whether there'll be broadband access readily available that will make Pandora, Spotify, general radio much better, cheaper delivery services. So it's not something I feel comfortable at the 10-year part. That's an idea of longevity of a business model. I'm not interested in lending to a real estate developer because I don't want a hole in the ground as part of my recovery. And then the other part of money good is valuation. So under the valuation basis, I look and say if the company were to put itself up today and they had an auction, who would come and buy them and what valuation? And this isn't, well, their peer group trades at 12 times earnings, therefore it's worth 12 times earnings. This is what kind of cash flow on an arithmetic basis would somebody like Lowe's, who's the Tisch family, or Leucadia, where I came from, who's a value investor, or Warren Buffett, who's a value investor, what kind of value investor would be willing to pay for this company at multiples where they can earn a high equity type return of a steady cash flow? And you take that number, and then you say, okay, now that we have a value in the capital structure on a strict priority basis, would we get paid off? So there needs to be significant equity cushion underneath of us to sort of meet that money good standard. So in Radio Shack that had bonds maturing earlier this year, you might believe that they were going to come out sooner than everything else. So therefore, you were going to be fine. I'm not interested in making that merry-go-round speculation because on a strict priority basis, I'm not sure they're money good. So that's the kind of credit standard we're looking at, and we're looking at primarily corporate debt because that's our area of expertise, and primarily in North America and in Europe. We also will look at mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, and non-credit, corporate credit. But as a general rule of thumb, we're going to look at corporate credit. And we're definitely not looking at emerging markets. I think that's a specialty area that is a unique sector. So these will not have emerging market debt in them. We have the ability in this portfolio. We have a lot of flexibility. So one of the things we have the flexibility to do is we do have the ability, if we think it's in the best interest of shareholders and it's clear cut, that we should be actively hedging out the portfolio. It's not something we would engage day to day, but it is something we have the availability to protect capital. We have the ability to invest in foreign currencies. In general, we'll hedge out the foreign currency debt. But it's something where, obviously, we have the ability to if we think that that would be a smart and appropriate way of handling the fund. We have the ability to buy income-producing equities. Again, it's not something I see as a regular ongoing business, and, in fact, we have not, nor do we expect in the near term to have income-producing equities. But, again, it has us the flexibility so we don't get pigeonholed. We can go where we need to go to do what I consider the smart thing to do, which is a conservative investment style, and take whatever that yield that conservative investment style produces. So that's the general concept of the fund. And then in portfolio specifics, I'm going to start top down and then move into a little bit more detail. So we expect this fund traditionally to hold between 60 and 80% non-investment grade securities, which means we expect that it will hold 20 to 40% investment grade securities. We expect this portfolio, we don't look at ratings, but if you work it out, the ratings would sort of be between a single B and a double B kind of portfolio. We don't look at ratings because there are plenty of triple C names that get paid off because they've been called, or plenty of names we've purchased even in the short-term fund that are in bankruptcy, but they're debtor in possession financing, so they're at the very, very, very top of the capital structure and they're currently paying. But we recognize that ratings, some people care about ratings. This is a portfolio that we expect will consist of 50 to 75% of money good debt and overlap with the short-term high-yield bond fund. So in general, we expect 15 to 35% overlap with the short-term high-yield bond fund, and the rest to be money good bonds that we're prepared to hold to maturity, but we wouldn't necessarily do. The rest of the portfolio will fall into various categories, which I'll describe in a few minutes. We value liquidity, so we expect a significant part of this portfolio to be of securities where we believe there's an active market to be able to transact in them. I think that's sort of going to cover most of the broad brush characteristics.
David, why don't you talk to, you know, some of the things that the fund can do by staying nimble in terms of, you know, not widely followed or just, you know, off the beaten path type kind of securities.
Yeah, I'm going to go through the individual categories.
Okay.
Now. So, like the short-term fund, every month we'll produce the portfolio and we'll produce various characteristics that I've mentioned, as well as individual categories of how you can look from a transparency sector into what each bond is. So we currently have identified 6 categories, although we're open to having more and we're open to suggestions. The 6 categories we have are short-term fund overlap. So that's specifically bonds that overlap with the River Park Short-Term High Yield Bond Fund. And then we will subsequently break those out into the traditional short-term high-yield bond fund categories of short-term maturity, event-driven, cushion bonds, strategic recap, and called and redeemed debt. And to give you an idea, the October numbers are already out. The November numbers aren't yet. But to give you an idea, you know, I'll give you an idea of what it looks like last night, for instance. Can I do that, Morty?
Yeah, in broad percentages.
Right. So the short-term fund overlap as of last night was 28% of the fund. And of it, there were 0 called redeemed debt, which makes sense because out of the 28, 0 out of the 28 was 0 because that's where we're capacity constrained and it's coming into December and we want to maximize that for the short-term fund. But in strategic recap and event-driven, which are very short-term in nature, that's 15% of the 28%. And the remaining amount is in short-term maturities and in interest-sensitive items like cushion bonds. As of last night, about 25% of the portfolio were money good buy-and-hold bonds that we'd be prepared to hold the maturity but wouldn't necessarily. The next category is a category called priority-based, but I affectionately call it dented credits above the fray. This will typically be 15 to 25% of the portfolio. I think we add a lot of value here. And let me explain what a dented credit above the fray is. So a dented credit is a company that has, in our opinion, too much debt and or has industry issues, which creates a potentially over-levered situation. And these companies may not restructure or may not file bankruptcy. They just may be over-levered zombies, or they may actually cure themselves. So Level 3 years ago was an over-levered company that has sort of worked its problems out. And the way they work their problems out is they either do equity issuance, they sell assets, they grow their earnings and their revenue out of their problem, or they're even able to refinance their existing debt for a lower coupon debt or more favorable covenants or a combination thereof that allows them the flexibility. When you look at the total debt of these companies, there's just too much, in my opinion. I'm not comfortable in owning the entire capital structure. But in many of these companies, primarily first mortgages and debtor loans, even second mortgages, we're very comfortable holding it. And we're being paid a lot of money to have the potential risk of a process. So my attitude is, fine, you go through a process. We may have a little bit of volatility in those specific positions, but if I'm going to get all of my interest and all of my principal at the end of the process or even during the process or even before the process begins by being refinanced out with debtor in possession financing, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. So one of the ways I try to explain to people to think about it, it's sort of like you have a homeowner who has a first mortgage, a second mortgage, and a home equity line, and both the husband and wife are working, and they're generating enough income that their house that is currently was under, you know, currently the value of the house exceeded the debt, but today, let's say, equals the debt. So they think they could sell their house for probably their debt, but then they'd have no equity or maybe a little more and maybe a little less. And they're both working so they can easily service their mortgage. But all of a sudden, the husband loses his job. Now they've got issues. They're going to burn through savings pretty quickly, and they could find themselves in foreclosure. Well, I don't want to own the home equity line, which is at the bottom of the chain schedule and really not secured. I certainly don't want to own the second lien. But the first lien, if the first lien debt today at today's market value is 60% loan-to-value or 70% loan-to-value, I might be very comfortable owning that. I may have to live through a foreclosure process, but I would get paid at the end of the day. So that's how I sort of describe dented credits above the fray. And again, I think that'll be 15 to 25% of the portfolio. We have a history of being very, very good in that area. I think a lot of our skill set in that area comes from our fact that we have a bread-and-butter alternative investment business where we are long-short credit, primarily focused on distressed. So I think that's where we can add some significant value. And like even in the short-term fund, we've added value by participating in developing debtor in possession financing. It was 100% high quality that got paid off. This is an area where I think we add a little extra special sauce to the recipe here. The next category we have is off the beaten run. So that's exactly what you would expect. It's sort of off the beaten run. It means on any given day, you would tend to think there's smaller issues or more or very, very highly concentrated, held small issues, or sort of not well-followed issues. They may or may not, on the off-the-beaten-path, necessarily be liquid. In other words, the general perception is they're not liquid. But I can give you an example where I think we added some value. We'll wait and see at the end of the day, but I think we added some value. And we participated in off-the-beaten-path financing where it's extremely liquid and I can sell the entire position at the blink of a hat at the moment. So some of you may be familiar with Checkers Drive-In, which is a hamburger drive-in chain and has a large franchise customer base as well as company-owned stores. And that's important because I think franchise stores have much better return on equity and a much better cash flow pattern and do generally have higher valuations. And Checkers was a, I would say, zombie, sort of plodding along. It was sort of not growing. It wasn't shrinking too badly. It was sort of just generating its cash, doing its thing, but not doing anything particularly fancy. When it was taken over by Wellspring, which was a private equity firm. And Wellspring and the management team that took it over actually put some new life into it. The company's actually performing quite well, has grown. Wellspring's had it for a significant period of time. And they also happen to be marketing a new private equity fund. So Wellspring has earlier filed the intent to take this public in the first half of next year. But, you know, because they're interested in showing exited returns or partial realizations and because they get a performance fee when they realize and because it's the end of the year, they were approached about possibly creating a holdco piece of paper. So currently they have operating company debt, which we're very comfortable with and we've owned. But they were approached with owning a small holdco, which is subordinate to the operating company debt, to allow them to get some cash out of the deal today. It was originally hoped to be a $50 million deal, of which Wellspring was very eager to participate. And I think the management of Checkers was not so eager to participate because they viewed this as financial engineering run amok and not something that was necessarily needed. Or not needed for what they consider the right reasons. So it got scaled down to $25 million, in our opinion, and we participated. We owned $15 million of that $25 million issue. But it was a piece of paper where if they go public, they have to take us out at 103. The debt was issued, I can't remember if it was 98 or 99, has a 12% coupon on it. I actually sort of was hoping we wouldn't get taken out. And has some very, very good cash flow sweeps and covenants. So there's something where, again, our area of expertise in structuring and financing and debt, I think we created an off-the-beaten-run path that's adding a lot of incremental yield. But what's more interesting is the day it got announced as a public deal, there was a group of about six to eight core holders of Checkers bonds, and three of them came running in to the underwriter saying, you know, we'd like to buy that paper. So we could easily sell that paper, I think, at or above the current market value. So that's an example, in my opinion, of an off-the-beaten run that I think is kind of interesting. The only sad thing about this is it's hard to buy more of it, and we have, unfortunately, the fund started to grow, so it's having less of an impact than it did a month ago. But we'll see others. Then we have a category called interest rate resets. We can't come up with a good name. We do have a prize for somebody. We have a nice Cohansic umbrella that I'm happy to send one or two of if somebody can come up with a better name. But for now, we call them interest rate resets. And what these really are securities where in a rising interest rate environment will act much, much more defensive. Or if rates stay really, really low and we have such a short duration, we will necessarily get the benefit or a greater return than we would. So it's got characteristics where you get an outstripped return based on different profiles of interest rates. It helps us manage the portfolio characteristics of exposure with rising and lowering rates. So the classic example that I've told people about is a cushion bond where the yield to call is much, much lower than the yield to maturity. And in the short-term fund, I've used the explanation of you have a 12% bond that's callable today, 12% coupon, excuse me, bond that's callable today at 100 cents, on which means in 30 days they can take you out, pay you 100 cents. And let's say they trade for simplicity purposes at 101, and it has 2 years of a maturity. So if you buy it today at 101, and the company does what one would ultimately think would be the smart thing to do, which is to buy it out, if they do it the day you buy it, they announce a call or redemption or refinancing, you're buying something at 101, you're going to earn a point in interest, and you're going to lose a point premium because they call the bonds at 100 or par. So you make zero. But let's say 6 months go by, and they then call the bonds, then you'll have earned 6 points of interest. You'll have paid 101. You'll have lost a point in principal, but you'll have made 5 points on a 101. That's a very attractive yield. So as time goes on, your yield goes up dramatically. There are various reasons why these bonds stay outstanding, but the reason they're called cushion bonds is because even though your maturity or your duration is being extended on you, you're being compensated significantly by a rising interest rate. So if interest rates rise themselves, causing the bond from being attractive to be called today but being less attractive in the future, your yield also went up. So it's more less sensitive to interest rates. It's going to be more defensive. That's an example of an interest rate reset. And then the last category, we just lump in everything together, which is distressed, asset-backed, equities. So if a company's in bankruptcy, even if the plan that's currently confirmed is to give us 100% of our principal, all of our interest, and all of our interest on interest, okay? Or it's a bond that's paying us in bankruptcy, all of our coupon and all of our interest and everything we expect. Even in those categories, okay, because it's in bankruptcy, we would call it distressed. So you have to understand that we're very, very focused on keeping a company that's in bankruptcy a pure sort of category. So that's assuming it's not a short-term overlap. If it's a short-term fund overlap, it goes into that category first. So those are the five categories. So the real way to think about this is I think 50 to 75% of the portfolio will be buy and hold and short-term overlap. 15 to 35% is probably short-term overlap of that 50 to 75, leaving, by definition, 15 minus 75, 60% max of money good buy and hold to, I guess, as little as 35 and 50, 15% of money good buy and hold, because I'm subtracting out the short-term piece. I think 15 to 25% will be these dente credits above the fray, so you can see everything else sort of slots to the bottom.
Great.
Now you can go ahead.
I was hoping, David, to give folks a chance to ask you questions if we could.
Fine, that's perfect. I'm done pretty much anyway.
Well, that's so cool. Jamie, do you want to go through the routine for folks who would like to ask questions of David?
Sure. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one using a touchtone telephone. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two. Again, it is star and then one to ask a question.
Great. What I'll do is go through a few questions that folks had sent in, and then we'll check in with Jamie to see if the folks listening had questions of their own. A lot of folks had been curious about the difference between portfolio yield, because you're quoting like a 7 or 8% yield on the portfolio, and the kind of monthly payout to investors, which looks like a kind of lower yield than that. And I didn't know if David or Morty might say a word about how the kind of size of the portfolio is playing into making sense of those numbers.
Sure. Yeah, this is Morty. I'll take that. So the concept of what you distribute as income as part of a dividend yield to shareholders is really a tax issue as opposed to a investment return issue. So I mean, I think as David sort of suggested, as a fund grows in size, which is really typical of a small fund like this that's sort of new, that's, you know, growing over time, and this is pretty typical of funds that are in their first, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of their life, what happens is the asset levels of those funds typically are much larger at the end of the month than they are on average during the month. And so if you think about it, so the first cut at this question really is think about what is the average return that the fund has yielded during the course of the month, but they're paying it out based on the assets at the end of the month in terms of a dividend every month. So it's really it's almost like a tax shelter. You're actually minimizing the taxes that you're having to pay on a higher return. So this is actually very good news that the actual dividend is less than the return. So if you look at the fund, for example, if you look at the fund in the first couple of months, it's actually yielding very strong numbers. The return in the first month of operation was, you know, a little shy of, well, I'll pull it up here, a little shy of 1%. So it was 82 basis points. And the return in October was 1.04%. In November was 0.82%. So it's actually yielding at a rate of a 10% return annually. And the fact that we've been able to distribute a smaller amount of dividends is actually to the benefit of shareholders, and that's basically the fund growing in size during that period of time.
Cool, thank you. And when you talk about growing in size, you talked about a $2 billion capacity. Does that imply a closure of the fund far in advance of $2 billion, or do you have a sense of when you might want to slow down the inflow?
Marty, can I take that?
Sure.
Okay, so the $2 billion is not a hard close number. Maybe
right.
It's $1.5 billion, maybe it's $2.5 billion. I mean, I think we're going to close it when we think it's appropriate, and we've proven that we're willing to do that. And we're also going to close it ideally before it becomes a problem. You don't want to wake up and say, oh, my God, now I need to close. You want to wake up and say, we're closing. We've got plenty of margin for error, and we're just cutting off our revenue base to do the smart thing for our shareholders. The $2 billion number comes about strictly because we expect that this fund to hold 35 to 70 positions in general. And it's a question of how many positions can we hold using, let's say, 60 to 70, where if five positions generally represent 20 to 30% or 20 to 35% of the portfolio, and the rest represent the remaining amount, how many of those positions can we actually sell in the open market? So we want to be small enough that when we want to realize the potential that's been reached on a bond and not give it back, or we want to get out of a bond when we realize there's a problem, we can move the bonds without having a problem. So I can move 10 or 20 million bonds today. I can't move 50. You know, I have a friend who runs a mutual fund with leveraged loans, and we were sitting down having dinner, and he says, I'm worried about my portfolio. I said, well, just sell it. He says, well, I only own 7 million bonds, but in the firm we own 82, so we have a problem. I don't want to be in that position. So effectively, what's driving the capacity constraint here is the ability to be nimble in unwind positions.
David, you should recognize, and I'm sure you do, mm-hmm. that our MO is that, you know, as a fund reaches its capacity, we're more likely to close the fund to new investors but allow existing investors to continue to add more money into the fund. And that would be our first sort of step at trying to slow down the flows as opposed to closing it off completely to, you know, additional investments.
Cool. No, that makes perfect sense. Do you have a sense, David, about how much international exposure you might anticipate having in the fund? You'd mentioned some European bonds.
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be primarily U.S. companies, but for instance, there's plenty of international companies that we're perfectly happy, primarily U.S. dollar denominated. In the portfolio today, as I'm looking here, I think we have a couple. One's an asset-backed deal, and I think we may have like one or two other non-U.S. positions. But the rest are all U.S. In general, you would expect most of the portfolio to be U.S. issuers because that's the primary dominating provider of of credit, but you know, we have some Post Media that's Canadian. We have the Asset Back, which is Canadian. Again, those are North American, but they're not in the States.
Right. And these would all be developed countries with no emerging market debt.
Right. Yep. Jamie, did we have folks who had questions?
Yes, we do. Our first question comes from Bill Fuller. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you for this. I had two, if possible. The first is, what is your expectation of the relative volatility of the fund relative to high yield in general? What would be your hope in terms of volatility level?
Again, look, the fund has, we think the ideal maturity right at the moment is about the 3 to 5 year, primarily the 4 year part of the curve, because it's where you earn a real interest rate return. I'm comfortable with where we are on the tail risk, and you get some benefit from the roll down the curve, and we think the 1 to 3 year space on outright maturities can be very, very expensive because people are clamoring there. And I think being away from the top 100 high-yield issuers or away from the index, there's a lot more value. So by nature, the 100 names in the high-yield index tend to go up more than we're likely to go up quicker. They tend to go down quicker than we will as well, because they're generally momentum-driven flows. And we think the credits we own underlying the portfolio will have less volatility associated with that on a short-term basis. In general, historically, since we manage Glanzik, we're generally more defensive, so we generally don't capture nearly as much of the ups in a quick run-up of the market, and we don't capture as much as the downs in a quick downside. The other thing is, this portfolio is not 100% junk. It has investment-grade securities. And it's particularly, I think, defensive to interest rate rising. So, you know, I don't know what the volatility is going to be on a relative basis. I would expect the volatility to be a lot less. I mean, I think there are other bond funds in the strategic income space that some folks might be familiar with, and I think that those funds, I think, are reflective to what kind of volatility we think we'd have.
Thank you. My other quick question was, my understanding is we're having record amounts of borrowings running, you know, $2 trillion a year or something like that. Does that mean that your universe is expanding that quickly?
Hello?
Yep.
Okay. First of all, I think that's a little bit of a misnomer, because most high-yield debt is debt being refinanced that was coming due, or bank debt that was being refinanced as bonds, or bonds being refinanced as loans. I don't think there's a huge amount of new issuance, and generally, when there's a huge amount of new issuance, it's generally from the private equity side. The industry as a whole has had huge expansion, in the sense that the high-yield market traditionally represented, in the railroad days, let's say 18 to 22% of the corporate bond market. Even in the 80s and 90s, it was, you know, 20-25% of the corporate bond market. And today, it's estimated the high yield represents as much, over 50% of the corporate bond market. I've seen numbers as high as 60.
Wow.
So I think the universe in general is growing, because as rates have come down and the earnings yield on stocks have gone from a negative spread to 10-year treasuries to a positive spread, I think you're just seeing more financings and more availability of financing. But, you know, I don't think the supply is really affected, other than creating more in the universe, spreads. I mean, spreads are still sort of fair value right at the moment, on the richer side of fair value,
mm-hmm.
And you have a huge issuance. So you certainly have the supply table acting up with that as well.
Thank you.
Other questions, Jamie?
Our next question comes from Thomas Leinert. Please go ahead with your question.
I'll direct this one to Morty if he's still there. This question may seem premature, given that the fund is brand new, but the strategic income fund has been described as a step out from the short-term high-yield fund in terms of its potential returns and its risk. Is this a trend? Will you at some point introduce a fund that's a step out from the strategic income, or is this the extent of it?
Well, there's no plans to do that yet, but You know, but that would be something that we would consider, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. I mean, the market environment that we're in right now, you know, it's clearly defense. We want to be defensive. David wants to be defensive. And the strategic income fund makes sense to us as a place to put in a lot of money. And but if the interest rate environment changed over the next 4 or 5 years, it might create a situation where, you know, it would be opportune to launch something that even had a higher risk profile. David, do you want to add anything to that?
I'm afraid to, because every time I come into Morty and Matt Kelly's office, I have a great idea for something we can do as either an extension or a derivative or, you know, in our SAC, or a friend of mine has a good SAC, and he's like, could you please go back and just focus on, you know, one fund at a time, please? So I'm afraid to say anything at this point. We do
good
manage.
Answer. Good answer, David.
We do manage multiple strategies across the credit spectrum as a firm as a whole. Not that easy.
Thank you very much.
Great, Jamie.
And we do have an additional question. This comes from Kirk Kazanian. Please go ahead with your question.
Hey, David, along those lines, I was just curious, do you consider these funds to be more of core bond funds? If someone's thinking about putting together an overall portfolio and wants to have a bond allocation, do you consider either the short-term high yield or strategic income to be appropriate for a complete core portion of one's portfolio, or do you view that more as what one might put in high yield per se? And then I'm also curious, I might have missed this if you mentioned it earlier, but how the funds have been so remarkably stable, how would that change if and when we started to see some tapering and interest rates went up? What kind of volatility would you expect from both of the funds?
So I, you guys are the professionals. You guys figure out how to classify things and where they fit and what the right category is and how they meet an investor's needs. You know, I have lots of ideas on how it fits people's needs. I'm not sure how to classify benchmarks or categories. I do it because I'm asked to. I'm not sure it's the right way to do it. So I'm a little hesitant to go down that line of inquiry. I'll give you some general feelings on how I think about them. I'll start with the short-term high-yield fund. You know, I think of the short-term high-yield fund as a cash enhanced strategy or cash alternative. With sort of a maturity holder who's going to hold cash for more than 3 months and may need the cash sooner than a year. So to me, it's the ideal profile. I had a client who said, I have a kid who's a junior in college, and I've saved all their money for, I mean, junior in high school. I saved all their money for college, so I don't need to try to make any more money. They're done. I just want to make sure that money's safe, but I don't want to put it at, you know, 0.5%. And I look and say, well, the short-term high-yield fund's a great, great product for you because, you know, you can put it here and you're going to know 6, 9, 12 months from now when you need the money, and you're not going to need it all at once, right? You're going to step it out over 4 years. And this fund's generating a return that exceeds the 10-year treasury and has done very well. I mean, in the third quarter of 2011, which was the fourth worst quarter in high yield, the institutional shares were down 1 basis point. So it clearly knows how to hold value. And earlier this year in May, April, May, and June, when rates were going up, you know, people sent me notes congratulating me. I said, you know, great, except it's a short duration fund and rates went up. So what happened is what I would expect. That's how I think about the short-term fund. Everybody seems to think of it. I know people who have said, I'm making it my high yield, 30% of my high yield allocation. You know, to me, that's fine. That's what they're doing. You know, maybe what they're really saying is, I'm bearish on the world, or I'm concerned about rising rates, so I want to be conservative, so I'll call it high yield, and it's going to drag my return in good times and enhance it in bad times. Yeah, so I've sort of gotten out of the business of, you know, what is the right category. and the strategic income fund, look, it's got a longer duration. It's definitely going to have more volatility. I think it's important for people to think about, and something that's stressed all the time at Leucady is that a mark-to-market or a permanent impairment. If it's a permanent impairment, we made a mistake. You lost money. That is real. If it's a mark-to-market and you're planning to hold it to maturity, you're going to get it back because every day you're grinding closer to that event date where you're going to get the money back. So what feels like a loss, and it works in the opposite, what feels like a great gain is going to unwind itself to the yield to maturity at the time you bought it. I do want to caution people that this fund is only going to hold 60-80% high yield, is my expectation. So comparing it to a high yield index or a high yield fund is probably not appropriate. It's not probably not appropriate for two reasons. One, it doesn't have 100% mandate to own high yield. It's a go wherever you think is smart, broader-based component that will own asset backs, which we do. And the other thing is it's not a total return fund. You know, a lot of the high-yield funds are buying, especially the bigger ones, sort of a core group that's index-like, and then they're trying to get incremental yield with total return. What's going to get upgraded? What's going to have an event? You know, this is, am I being paid a really high-quality return for the kind of risk we're taking, and I will be prepared to hold to maturity. So I'll give you a non-investment grade. I mean, I'll give you an investment grade holding I love and that we'll continue to hold, and it's not high yield. We own something called MAV, which is Master Asset Vehicle. It was a structured product that was forced down in 2008 to solve some of the illiquidity among credit default swaps and asset backs and loans. And they put all this stuff together, and they tranched up into a new securitization, A1, A2, B1, B2.
This is a Canadian government.
And it was a Canadian solution. And when they did it, it was meant to run off, and primarily to run off the potential credit default swap liabilities that were written. And when those liabilities run off, the bonds that we own that are due in, I think, 2055 or some ridiculously long, actually are forced to come out. So they never thought about what they were going to do with the cash in a bad way. They viewed it as when it runs off, it runs off. And we'll force the trust to invest in Canadian government bonds or Canadian provinces, which are all sort of AA or better. So at the time, there was a positive carry on Canadian paper versus the cost of funding of this structured product. Today, it's negative. So the people that own A2s, Bs, Cs, they look and say there's been a huge appreciation from the time this was created. They want to unwind their potential liabilities, and they don't want to invest in Canadian governments. And there's no mechanism. There's no call provision. So they worked for almost 2 years with BlackRock. And finally, they've created these strips where they auction now every quarter. And we own the A1s. And there's more government bonds and government provinces in excess of all of the A1s. So it's almost like a defease muni. Well, I'm earning 4.5% plus for effectively a 3-4 year bond of a Canadian government bond. That's not high yield, but that's a no-brainer. Like, that's really smart. I'm happy to own that all day long. And what's the volatility of that? I don't think it's huge. So I'm happy to own components like that. So when I think about this, I actually do think of it more as a core bond portfolio yield product than I do very much anything else.
Great. Thank you. Would you consider owning municipals at all? I understand that they look pretty attractive now, even compared to taxables. I just wonder if you'd ever go into that area.
We have been opportunistic throughout the career of Cohansic and prior at Locadia in munis. The last time I took a very, very, very large stake in munis was when the auction rate muni market blew up, I think in 2007. We were probably the largest buyer of auction rate munis on the desk of A.G. Edwards. Most guys went to Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs. I thought you should go where you had a large underwriter that most people didn't think about. And I was pretty sure trucks were still going to drive through the roads of Kansas while I was being paid 12%. So that was an attractive opportunity. We've also been involved in munis when there was the mutual fund timing. You could buy industrial revenue bonds very cheap. In general, we'll consider munis. We're going to look at it on a yield basis, not an after-tax basis. So you're going to have be an opportunistic buyer of munis. And I'm not interested in buying things like charter schools, nursing homes, any of those things that are really financings that I think are not so great. In general, just so you're aware, I think most of you are not going to like this comment. As cheap as munis are, I think they're still not cheap enough. That's a general rule of thumb.
Great. Thank you.
Anyone left there, Jamie?
We do have an additional question. This comes from David Radisich. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi, and thanks for the opportunity for the conference. I actually have three quick questions. One is where you have the overlaps between the funds, and I guess they'd also overlap your privately managed accounts. How do you determine which one will actually get to purchase a particular security? And then the second question is, with some of these off-the-beaten-path securities in particular, do you have difficulty pricing them on a daily basis? And the third and last question is, how did you determine to have such a high minimum for your institutional shares?
Okay.
Great. And those might have to be our last questions, David, so why don't we work them through?
Okay. So the first one on overlap. First of all, we actually do not have a lot of managed accounts now. In fact, we basically have none. We have one, and that's a very minor account that's very narrow-focused that is similar to the River Park Short-Term High Yield Bond Fund. Almost all of the managed accounts we had, we told them they could go into the mutual fund or they could leave. The one that we do have is a large investor in our total return product as well, and they're really interested in a proration across the board. And I don't think it's for an offshore deferral, so I don't think it's going to be for very long. So in that particular managed account, it's strictly on proration, so they're generally suffering under investment because the mutual fund is so much larger than them and their minimum round lots you have to buy. And then in general, how do we determine the overlap between strategic and the short-term product? So the short-term product gets first dibs at everything that would be a short-term product, which means that where there's a capacity constraint, strategic won't get it, which is why today, I mean, strategic has, like in October, they owned a bunch of redeemed debt. For instance, BevMo, where we could buy more than we wanted to allocate. So let's say we had a 4% allocation to the short-term fund, and that's a full allocation. Now we can start buying for the other funds. But right now, because we're heading into December, you're going to start having a thinning of product. So the short-term fund is actually getting the benefit of those purchases. You know, as you get into the less certainty or the longer dated short-term securities, obviously there's less capacity constraints, and then they can own them on a proration of the portfolio basis. So I think that probably answers that question. On the off-the-beaten-path, look, we don't price the portfolio. There's an independent pricing service that is run by SEI that prices the portfolio. We ideally wish that every security we own was held by a bunch of people, and they priced actively every day, because I'm a big fan of transparency. And I like price discovery. One of the things that sometimes salesmen will say is, oh, this one you can put away and it won't price, and that to me is a negative. It doesn't have to be off the beaten path, by the way, for those kind of comments or characteristics to exist. So one is it's independently priced. Two, if we think it's independently priced, either too high, which does happen, or too low, which does happen, we provide documentation of either we transact, that's the easiest way to prove it, right? This is where it actually occurred, or we provide documentation from broker-dealer market makers, bids and asks, if it's dramatically different. And then the other way of solving that problem is you can go two-sided, or you can bid, as long as it's not trying to, you know, taint the tape, so to speak. So I think we do pretty good. The other thing you do have to remember is when I was at Locadia made a fortune and actively bought distressed financial assets, particularly in the insurance industry, where we had to price portfolios when we were buying the company and then unwind them. I think we're really good at the pricing aspect in the sense that even though it's independently priced, I think we have a good sense of what reality is in pricing and where and how to create liquidity and what the liquidity is. So I actually feel comfortable. I don't think you should focus on off the beaten path. I think you should think about it in general and all corporate debt, all asset backs, all mortgage-backed securities. And you have to also remember, high yield is extremely liquid today. You could have a 100 top name, and it may not be so liquid in an environment like the middle of October in 2008, especially if you have size. And then the last question I'm going to leave to Morty about, you know, why we made the institutional class so high.
Okay, so I guess first the institutional class, the minimum is $1 million. That minimum is waived for most intermediaries, so financial planners, brokers, advisors, and I believe in most situations, in most of the intermediaries, like a Charles Schwab, they charge a transaction fee on the institutional class. So it really becomes almost dollars and cents. I mean, if the level of assets are small enough, it actually is better to be in the retail class, paying the slightly higher expense ratio but not incurring the transaction fee, where if the sum is a larger sum, then you're amortizing that transaction fee across a larger amount of money over a longer period of time, and it pays to be in sort of the lower expense ratio. But you're going to begin to see this on the short-term high-yield fund effective immediately, and hopefully you'll see this soon on the strategic income fund, that we're going to be driving, hopefully, those expense ratios down over time. So those expense ratios on the short-term high yield fund are no longer what they were last year, and they're actually lower now than they were, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, and we haven't published those yet, but we'll be publishing those any day now. And we hope that that same thing will happen in the Strategic Income Fund, that we can drive those expense ratios down because of size.
Great. And David?
Yes?
I just want to let people know, I know you're about ready to wrap it up. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. And David Snowball has mentioned that our website looked pretty awful, and I have to admit it did. It's still under construction, but at least the landing page, I think, is much improved. And if you have any questions, feel free to tap on the landing page. And since if you click on anything, it doesn't go anywhere else except to contact us. It's easy for you to generate an email to send us with additional questions.
Great. And if there were people who've been queued up, but we weren't able to get to your questions, Jamie and the folks at Chorus Call will share that list with us. We'll forward on to Morty and David in the morning, and we'll surely try to get back to you. For now, I'd like to thank David and Morty and all of you for your time tonight. A recording of this call and an audio profile of the fund will be available at The Observer on January 1st. Highlights and a link to an MP3 of this call will be posted on The Observer's discussion board, to which you're all invited, probably within the next 48 hours if you don't want to wait until the January 1st posting date. After a kind of giddy year in the equity markets, we're hoping to speak with several managers of hedged funds in the first month of the new year. We're looking forward to speaking with another of the sub-advisors for River Park early in the year, and we're hopeful of speaking with Matt Moran, who we've talked to before, manager of the Aston Long Short Fund, River Road Long Short Fund. For now, thanks again to Morty and David. Thanks to you all. I hope you all have a good evening. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Have a good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's conference call. It has now concluded. You may now disconnect your telephone lines.